Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Wake Up to Purpose with your host, John Stanko. This program will help you find your purpose and, more importantly, how to make your purpose work for you. And now, here's John Stanko.
Hello out there in internet land. This is John Stanko, your host for Wake Up to Purpose, and it's time to start another week. I had thought, okay, this week I'll cut back to two or three shows, but boy, it just lined up for the week, and we just have some outstanding guests lined up for the week, and starting with today in a few minutes, Kim McCarthy, who tomorrow is her last day of quarantine after returning from Italy, serving there with Samaritan's Purse, and we want to hear all about that, what that experience was like, and she's had some other very interesting experiences, and we want to hear how she got into all this, and so we'll be bringing her on in just a moment and hearing all about what is going on in her life, and I'm really looking forward to it myself. I trust you had a good weekend. Where I live, it rained all Sunday. Saturday was a decent day, but I was on the phone all day with book appointments, interviews, editing, talking. I had a board meeting on Saturday afternoon. We've all become experts on Zoom during these days. I just wrap up a class for Ottawa University, so Wednesday I have to put the grades in, and this is a new system for me, and so I had a meeting with the dean earlier today with another Zoom meeting, and so how did we ever live? How did Jesus do it without Zoom? But he did, but we can't, and so I'm always trying to get more information from Kenya. We had some people here in the States talk to some of our partners in Kenya yesterday. Said it's very bad. People are hungry. The one woman we talked to runs a school, and we sent some money earlier in the month, and so she paid the teachers, but she told them, "That's all I have, so go pick crops," because there are some fields that are ripe, and so those teachers will have to go pick some vegetables and try to make some money. But even there, making the money is the food supply is a bit sparse because of the lockdown. And I heard on Saturday that their lockdown was extended for another 21 days. So this is a real hardship on the folks and that are there, and our friends and our partners and family and those we love. And that's why I'm very careful not to complain and not to murmur about what's going on here, whether my check came or whether the loan came through, because we at least have some of those safety nets we can look at. And I know there are inequities there, and it's they're not going to be distributed among 360 million people as some would hope, but I'm just very careful what I say, and that's why I urge people on social media to be as upbeat and as positive and as uplifting as possible. So I had a good weekend beyond being very busy. Publishing has really picked up for Urban Press as people get in touch during this season where they have a little bit more time, and things that they have been putting off writing and doing, they seem to be more open to it at this point in time. So one of our authors got his proof book yesterday. Another one finalized his look today, and we'll be getting that out. And on my call to Ottawa University, they have a customized copy of my book, Life is a Goldmine, that they were about to distribute to all the students, but now that'll have to hold off to the fall. They had the books, but April 8th, we're going to be having a special meeting campus-wide and distribute the books, but that will have to wait, as are many things, I'm sure, in your own life as well. So I did a Facebook Live this morning. I'm doing those 3 days a week and trying to encourage people, posting every day, trying to put 10, 12, 15 sayings out there, teachings even in very short form to stir people up and get them sharing and talking and agreeing and disagreeing in a good kind of way. So I don't know when this ends or where we go from here. I guess in our state we have probably another week to go. And I know where my daughter lives in Virginia. They have till May 17th. And so, but even there, this is going to be like people emerging from, like a bear emerging from its den in winter, just to check after winter's done, to check out and see how things are going on. Anyway, let's read Psalm 91. And if you're familiar with this show, you know that we start at the very beginning to read a different version, a different translation of Psalm 91 to get the full gist and to hear the promises made in this psalm in different wording, and that the translators come from maybe a little different perspective. Now, today we're reading from the Passion Translation, and the Passion Translation is a relatively new translation that was done by one man, from what I could tell, based on my research, and it's a little controversial, as many translations are, because people want to believe that what they are receiving in the way of a translation is as close to the original languages as possible. But that's easier said than done. And I know I've had people who are very adamant that the King James Version is the best and only version to be used. I do not subscribe to that. I believe there is value in the future or the later translations, but it's not an easy job. Every translator has to make decisions. And I mentioned this last week that when I speak and my message is being interpreted live in a church or at a meeting, the person interpreting has to make decisions of how to translate what it is that I say, because it may not be word for word. The concepts may not transfer to the other culture. I had a friend who's now gone home to be with the Lord. He was a Wycliffe Bible interpreter, and he worked with the Aztecs in Mexico. First thing, they had to go in and they had to develop an alphabet for the Aztecs. They did not have a written alphabet. Once they did that, then they got involved in translating from English and sometimes even the Greek and the Hebrew to Aztec. And he said they there were some concepts they had to discuss over a two-week period. They had to call in headquarters to try and get some resolution of what they were trying to say and the options that were there for them. So it's not easy. And so I looked over Psalm 91 in the Passion Translation. Looks pretty good to me. I wouldn't necessarily want to read John's Gospel in the Passion Translation, but I think Psalm 91 were okay. The title, the heading is Safe and Secure. And this is what the interpreter, what the translator wrote. When you sit enthroned under the shadow of Shaddai, you are hidden in the strength of God Most High. He's the hope that holds me in the stronghold to shelter me, the only God for me and my great confidence. He will rescue you from every hidden trap of the enemy, and he will protect you from false accusation and any deadly curse. His massive arms are wrapped around you, protecting you. You can run under his covering of majesty and hide. His arms of faithfulness are a shield, keeping you from harm. You will never worry about an attack of demonic forces at night, nor have to fear a spirit of darkness coming against you. Don't fear a thing. Whether by night or by day, demonic danger will not trouble you, nor will the powers of evil launched against you. Even in a time of disaster, with thousands and thousands being killed, you will remain unscathed and unharmed. You will be a spectator as the wicked perish in judgment, for they will be paid back for what they have done. When we live our lives within the shadow of God Most High, our secret hiding place, we will always be shielded from harm. How then could evil prevail against us or disease infect us? God sends angels with special orders to protect you wherever you go, defending you from all harm. If you walk into a trap, they'll be there for you and keep you from stumbling. You'll even walk unharmed among the fiercest powers of darkness, trampling every one of them beneath your feet. For here is what the Lord has spoken to me. Because you have delighted in me as my great lover, I will protect you. I will set you in a high place, safe and secure before my face. I will answer your cry for help every time you pray, and you will find and feel my presence, even in your time of pressure and trouble. I will be your glorious hero and give you a feast. You will be satisfied with a full life and with all that I do for you, for you will enjoy the fullness of my salvation. So there you have Psalm 91 in the Passion Translation. Again, the translator made a decision where it says in the original that you'll trample on snakes and scorpions and lions. What he translated, you'll even walk unharmed among the fiercest powers of darkness. Now, I don't disagree with that interpretation, but that is not really the best translation, and there is a difference. Anyway, that's not why you have tuned in to listen today. So the bottom line is the promises of Psalm 91 are available to us, as I have said over and over again. We trust him for healing if we get for health. If we get sick, we trust him for healing. If we succumb to the sickness, we trust him for salvation. We are safe and secure in the Lord. Well, let's go ahead and bring our guest on today, Kim McCarthy. Kim, welcome to Wake Up to Purpose.
I'm glad to be here. Thank you for inviting me, Dr. John.
Yeah, I was driving last week, and I was talking with my wife. We were going to the store, nothing dramatic, and then we were talking about you, and I realized that you were back, and I thought, boy, you'd be a great guest to talk to because it's so current and so relevant. Just tell our listeners where you've been, and then let's get into what it was like and what the experience was like for you.
Okay, so I just got back from Cremona, Italy. I work for Samaritan's Purse, and we were there, gosh, when did I go? Probably about 6 weeks ago, and I got back about 2 weeks ago. We set up an emergency field hospital in the parking lot of the Cremona Hospital, which their hospital is about 600 beds. And this was an area in the Lombardy region. So in the news for being very the epicenter for Europe and definitely for Italy and for COVID. And so that's what we did. And our purpose was to help that hospital with the overflow and the stress that they had. They were a 600-bed hospital. They had reserved 100 beds for pediatrics, 100 beds for OBGYN, and then the rest of the 400 beds were COVID patients. They were a hospital that normally had an 8-bed ICU, so that would need 8 ventilators. And they, when we got there, had 55 ventilators. They had people all over the place. The ICU nurses were taking 8 patients. 8 ventilated patients, where in the States and most of the world, you would take 2 ventilated patients. So everybody was overworked, so many sick people. So, there was just a backlog. So once people even get well off a ventilator, it's a month potentially before they even can make any real progress. So what we did is we set up our hospital, and we had a 10-bed ICU. We had 10 ventilators, and then the rest of the beds were wards. We had a couple male wards and a couple female wards.
How many beds?
So 10, so that was 58 ward beds and 10 ICU beds.
Okay.
68 beds total.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so what we would do is we would get our patients, they would bring us the patients. So we didn't have a triage area where patients would come to us. When we had an open bed, we'd say we need another patient. And then they would either we'd go get them or they would bring them to us.
Mm-hmm. Did you feel like they welcomed you? Did they understand who you were, why you were there? Was there any tension or was there a good cooperation?
There was a great cooperation. Yeah, it makes me get teary. Mm-hmm. They were just so happy to have us.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. They were very gracious, mm-hmm. and they just constant, even the community, every day, like these like baskets of just like homemade tarts and bread. And I mean, around Easter, honestly, we had like a 50-pound chocolate bell. I mean, they just kept sending and thanking.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, just they were really grateful.
Oh, well, you've been to Kenya with me, so I know how deeply
yes.
you care. And so you just take a deep breath. You take your time. But tell us, talk to us about your day. Talk to us about your day. I mean, what was it? Where did you live? Where did you eat? What goes on in setting up a field hospital like this? And how, I mean, you were a volunteer, but I mean, how many hours were you working? Just give us an overview of what was
okay.
you were asked to do and what the situation was like where you were.
Okay. So we have the DC-8, the Samaritan's Purse has a DC-8 that they loaded everything up on, the tents, all of our supplies. I did not fly on the DC-8. I came 2 days later, but there was some of my team flew on the DC-8. I flew commercial. So they set those up in the parking lot. Actually, the Italian Army helped us set those up, and they used the same tents. So, boom, they got them up real quickly. And then when I got there, we started receiving patients. We were fortunate enough. Initially, it was like, bring your sleeping bag. We don't know where we're sleeping, which can happen. You know, sometimes you just sleep in a tent. You don't really know. Especially when you go out first, where you're going to be, what's going to be going on. So as I was packing, they said, no need for the sleeping bag. Someone has offered to pay for us to stay in a hotel, which was absolutely wonderful. So we all stayed in the hotel. Initially, I didn't have a roommate, but then I did. And then we would take, of course, the city buses weren't working, but they hired their city buses to take us to and from the hospital, which was really only like a 5-minute drive. But they also were shelter in place. So we weren't permitted, of course, to walk to the hospital. I was fortunate enough to be on the day shift the entire time. Usually we rotate, but it just worked out. The night shift was happy with their situation and we were too. And so we just kept it that way. But so I would leave. We'd have devotions at 6:15 in the morning. A meeting at 6, announcements at 6:15, and then devotions at 6:25, and then the bus would leave at 6:35 to go to the hospital. We also, in the hotel, that's where we do all of that, and there was breakfast set up for us there. And so then we would go to the hospital. We had a changing room where we'd change into our scrubs. And then we would don into just our PPE. So we had a tent set up where we'd put on everything to protect us from the virus. And then we would always pray before we went in. And then we would just go in and, you know, begin to take care of the patients or get report from the next shift. So we did that every day, all day, for 4 weeks. I had a half day off about halfway through, and then the day before I came home, I had a day off. So basically, there usually aren't too many days off with this type of work. You're just focused, and there's a lot to be done, and you know, the staffing is such that's usually how it works out. So I was just going to say, so then taking a break. So once you go in, you're in what's called the hot zone, and everybody is wearing PPE at this point. And you can't, to come out, you need to take everything off. So you need to go through a doffing station. So we would maybe take one break in the morning and then maybe a break for lunch. Some days, maybe just even a 30-minute break. So it was just labor, and you know, it's labor intensive to come in and out, and you can't just run out and go get a quick snack or get a drink of water. It's and you can't eat or drink while you're in there, of course. So
So what, you'd get there, what, you'd start at 7 and go till 7 at night, or what would the schedule be?
Yeah, that is. So we'd get in there probably around 7, and then the next shift would come in at 7. We'd give report, and then once again, doff out, change into street clothes, and head for the bus. And the bus would leave at 7:45 to go back to the hotel. And then dinner would be waiting for us. And we would eat there. And then, you know, hopefully try to be in bed by 9. So, yeah, dinner was maybe like 8:15 till whenever you wanted it to be. And then you just would get up and do it all again the next day. So that's very full days. We had about 70 people, and that includes the administrative people, the water and sanitation, the pharmacist, you know, other allied health professionals as well. So it's a pretty big team.
Yeah.
And we had
and so some
members,
would work day, some would work night, some would work day and night.
Some would work days, some would work nights.
Okay.
Yeah, so it was, yeah, it was a 24/7 operation. We had one doctor in our ICU for the day shift, and then there was one doctor for nights. As time went on, we did gain another doctor who would kind of rotate through at different times. And
yeah. If you're just tuning in, we're talking to Kim McCarthy. She's sharing right now her experience of serving as a volunteer at the Field Hospital for Samaritan's Purse in Cremona, Italy. And she's been back for a couple of weeks. And Kim, what was the sickness like? What were you seeing in the patients? What were you treating? And and maybe even touch on the ventilator. There's, you know, some controversy, you know, where the ventilators help, not help. You said you had some on, they came off. Just share what you observed as a nurse in the context of the symptoms of this disease, of this pandemic.
Okay. So most of our patients, I'd say the age in the ICU, I can speak mostly to. The youngest patient we had was maybe in his 40s. The oldest was maybe 80, but most were probably, I'd say, between 60 and 70. We had just as many women as we did men. I know that's been something saying, oh, it's affecting the Italians, more men. But, I mean, in our case, once again, we received patients from the hospital. They chose who would come to us, so we didn't get them necessarily right away, and they chose. Mm-hmm. So for us, that's kind of what we had. Most of them would come to us. They'd been sedated and paralyzed for quite a while. We can give paralytic drugs that really help reduce the use, your body consuming oxygen. And sometimes when people are using a lot of oxygen, it just helps preserve oxygen for the body. So, and also, they were so busy over there that was probably the safest and best thing to do for the patients. So it took a little while for people to wake up, if they were going to wake up. And they were sick. They were all very, very sick. And some had what, you know, they call the comorbidities, where it's diabetes or heart disease. Some did not. And it just was like these were people just living their lives, and boom, now they are on a ventilator, which is basically a machine that helps give you oxygen. It's life sustaining. They wouldn't have lived without it. And we kept saying they look so young, and it's like I think. We thought they looked young because in general they were living pretty healthy, full lives, even with their comorbidities. Like they were pretty healthy. If they had comorbidities, they were well managed, most likely. And so, yeah, it was like an like one of the nurses I worked with, she was talking about it, and she's like, yeah, every day we have to bring our A game, because 1 minute they look completely fine. Like all of their numbers look good. They're waking up. You know, we think we're going to be able to, they'll wake up and be strong enough to get off the ventilator. And the next minute they're just not stable at all. So many unknowns with the virus. It was causing, there's a lot of blood clots that can form, not necessarily like emboli. So an embolus is like a clot that floats through your body and lodges somewhere. It was more what's called a thrombus or a thrombi, and it just is a blood clot that forms and just stays there. So, you know, lungs, kidneys, livers, just with these clots. It mimicked, the virus mimicked like other infections. So they watch for what's called inflammatory markers. It's just a blood test. And when you have inflammation, it shows that there's an infection. So they were always high, and then they dipped down. But if they came back up again, then you considered maybe there's a secondary bacterial infection that we need to be concerned with. And it just, they were just sick. They were just really, really sick people. And then once they came off the ventilator, they were so incredibly weak. That was always a big concern. Will they be, because there's a lot of mucus that forms in the chest, and they have to be able to cough that up. And, they could barely move. And we just started getting people up, whether they could move or not. We'd lift somebody into a chair or into a wheelchair, and we would just have them sit and have them cough. I mean, immediately after we took the tube out. And we had patients that were just so great. Like they saw where, you know, we had this one patient, I just loved him. And he was my first patient that came off of the ventilator. And he was so excited, and he's like, now I need to go home. And I'm like, why? You can't really move, so you can't. And then he's looking around, because we're in a tent, of course. And then we have a translator, and he's like, he asked her, he said, do you have any fire extinguishers in here? And we're like, so he's looking at our system, and we're like, you know, what? Like, why? What do you do for a living? And he's like, well, I'm an electrician. And he was just looking around thinking, I'm not sure I want to be in this place. So of course we showed him the fire extinguishers. Yes. And there was really, honestly, no, as far as we knew, like no rhyme or reason why somebody would recover and somebody wouldn't per se. There's just many, many, many unknowns. And the area that we were working in, that part of Italy is very academic. So, you know, a lot of research was being done. We did have one patient where we gave, I think it was called Regenerex, we gave a therapeutic drug to. And they were working on doing that plasmapheresis where they try to give people antibodies.
Wow. So it's. Did you have chaplains with you? Would they have a chance to talk to people, pray with people?
We had chaplains, and absolutely they prayed with people. Now, within the ICU, it was us that did that. Once they left the ICU, the chaplains would definitely pray with people. We, for us, we did, once our patients were able to, you know, sit up for a while, we would actually roll them outside with a blanket over them, so that one, they could be outside, and two, people could talk to them. And the chaplains definitely would. And we had chaplains that walked around our compound and prayed probably 24/7. We had chaplains that talked with patients, like once they were in the wards, and a lot of those patients would come out and sit in chairs and everything, definitely spent time with them. We also had chaplains, some of the same, it was kind of the same team, that would go to the fences that surrounded the compound, because the family members would come there. and they would just want whatever we could give them.
Sure.
And so they would pray with them. They would talk to them. They would, you know, try to find out information. And, you know, many people did come to Christ through that. And,
wow.
Yeah, it was pretty amazing. And a lot of some of the chaplains were from the U.S., but then there were also some evangelical Italian pastors that were there serving as well. So, you know, they were fluent and, you know, prayed with people, talked with people. We had Italian Bibles. Definitely the word was going out and the gospel was going out and people were coming to faith. We had a police officer come to faith. Yeah.
Wow, great work. Good job in a tragic situation. 4 weeks, is that a typical stint? Do you choose 4 weeks? Were you released after 4 weeks? How do you determine when you're on one of these deployments how long you stay?
Well, they typically, or I should say they always, like when they do a survey, they text you and do a Survey Monkey. I mean, you kind of get a feeling like we're probably doing something through emails, but when they figure out what they want, they'll say, you know, this is a minimum of 4 weeks, this is a minimum of 3 weeks. They'll kind of tell you what the minimum is. And then you can decide, does that work for me? And for me, I've always done 4 weeks. Even when it's three, I've done four. And that's what works for me. I feel that after 4 weeks, I'm just ready to go. As much as I love what I'm doing, it's time for me to go. And and they'll always ask, like, the first week that you're there, can anybody stay? Does anybody want to stay? And even though I just am feeling great at that point, I still just say, no, I think four is good for me. But then once I get home, that I, of course, I really miss it. And but I know that's what works for me.
Yeah, those are your boundaries. You're just tuning in. We're talking to Kim McCarthy. She's been telling us her story of serving in Italy with Samaritan's Purse in the Cremona area in an emergency field hospital treating patients with COVID-19 virus. Kim, I know a little bit about your purpose journey. Talk to our listeners about how you came to the decision, what went into the decision of becoming a volunteer for Samaritan's Purse in their international, is it correct to say their disaster division, or at least in their international outreach? Talk to us about that.
Yeah, it's like, okay. So I think really, you know, God's been working on me my whole life with that. And I never really, for my accountability, like I never really pursued it wholeheartedly, I guess, and was never really, encouraged to. And so I think definitely it was, you know, going to Kenya with you those two times, I think that's kind of opened the door. That's where it started, even though it started so much earlier in my life.
Sure.
Just being curious. Our church growing up, our missionaries were on the bulletin board. We supported them. We prayed for them, but I was always concerned, like, where are they? What's going on? Can we hear about this? And it was just like, don't worry about it. Which I wasn't worried. I was just curious. Mm-hmm. But I think, you know, going to ACAC, where missions is very important, and then coming to Kenya, and then, you know, just your message of purpose, just putting all those pieces together. And you know, that first time in Kenya, you know, just seeing, you know, just the kids and the work that the pastors were doing and that the other ministry workers were doing for these kids and just this life that they've given, to do that, and just the suffering and the and then the darkness that's there in Africa, but just how in that there was so much light. The light was so much brighter, and so that was kind of my first trip. And then the second trip, just thinking more about just I want to do more. Like, there is such great need everywhere, and I want to do more. And Cheryl Bradbury, our dear friend, mentioned Samaritan's Purse, because during that trip, she and Jeff had just taken the job down in North Carolina, and she mentioned DART. And so I applied, and it took some time, but I did the training, and then down in North Carolina. And I mean, the Lord just led me to that. But I really think there was other things that I needed to do to get there, and to realize that, yes, this is it, even though I kind of knew, but just mm-hmm. confirm it. And I think, you know, I was going through your purpose book about, like, the calling cards and, you know, what has your family said about you, and, you know, what drives you. And then there was another one. Are you, do you feel like you're being used to your best potential where you are right now? And I wasn't. I wasn't being used to my best potential where I was, even though I loved what I was doing and I loved the people. We had a good time. I worked for the Pittsburgh Marathon. I loved them. We, you know, it was just a really fun environment, and I think we did good work. But that wasn't, even though it was good, it wasn't the right thing for me. It wasn't where I was supposed mm-hmm. to be. So working through all of that and listening to the Lord, and then, you know, taking the steps with DART. And not even when I went to DART training, I was in this room with a lot of very experienced people. And we had to go around and just say what brought us there. And, you know, I had never been a career missionary. I've never worked for FEMA. You know, I'm none of those things. I talked about going to Kenya, and that I felt God was calling me to do this. I talked about, you know, my operational work at the marathon. I mean, you know, on a human level, it's like what I had to offer didn't even compare to what others had done. But yet I was there. Mm-hmm. And I was intimidated with it all. And I went back to my hotel, and, you know, I prayed about it, and I'm like, you know what, you have a binder and you have a name tag just like everyone else. I thought, well, you know, if this isn't the right course for me, then I'm just going to stay. I'm going to listen to what they have to say, because it may be a piece to the puzzle. But at the end of it, it was, this gives me a little weepy too, but I'm going to try not to. I think the end of it was that it wasn't really about what we were doing, but it was about, and it was definitely about that, but it was more about, like, the unity in Christ and the team. And because that's what's required when you do this type of work, because honestly, you can do this work in the United States too. But when you're doing this or anything for the Lord on a team, it's like the unity, you accomplish so much more with less effort when you go into it with the same heart. So I could tell that this group had that. So I'm like, okay, you know, mm-hmm. I'll figure out the rest as I go. But I know that we're all on the same, you know, we have the same beliefs, mm-hmm. And we want to practice those within our faith while working. So, mm-hmm. And I've worked for a nonprofit before, so.
Anyhow. Yeah, I love the way you've worked. You've processed the information, and you thought about it, you prayed about it, you concluded certain things, you came to certain conclusions based on your values, and almost at one point, why wouldn't the Lord want me to do this? And it was like the door was open, and, you know, God was saying, what do you want to do? Yes. We've got about 15 minutes. I want to make sure, was your first deployment, was your first call to the Ebola, was that where you went first?
Now, my first trip, my first call was to Bangladesh Rohingya refugees for diphtheria.
Mm-hmm.
That was my first trip. That was like February of 2018. So our Kenya trip, that last Kenya trip was that I did was 2017. And then I started pursuing this, went to DART training in August of 17, and then it was like February of 18. That I went to Bangladesh.
And then
it was Congo
to
twice.
Twice.
I went to Congo twice, once in like February of 19 and then in June of 19. And then I went to the Bahamas in fall of 19 for the hurricane. And then this last trip to Italy.
You know, when we hear Ebola, you know, of course, when we would go to Africa, people thought it was everywhere, and you know, but that is something people are familiar with. You did two tours, if I can call it that, two deployments to the Congo. Talk to us about your experience in the Congo and dealing with Ebola.
Well, Ebola was that deployment that I had been praying. Lord, I feel like I want to deploy again after Bangladesh. And then, boom, like within 12 hours, I get this email about Ebola. And I'm like, Ebola? Like, I wasn't thinking Ebola. But he walked me through that. So that was in August and just little steps that I took until December when they're like, do you want to come to training? And we're going to deploy. And I just said yes. So I said, yes. Yeah. So even with the training, they're like, this does not mean that you have to go. So they never make you always choose to go. So I did the training. Ebola was very different, of course, than anything. It's deadly. I mean, if you get it, 66% chance that you're not going to live. And then there was just so much instability in the region. So it was stressful. But once again, we had a great team, and, Samaritan's Purse is so organized with everything that they do, their travel, their security. There are people that are looking at things all of the time. So it's not just a random, let's just go treat Ebola in the Congo. I mean, it's very well organized. And we just have some people that were in Liberia for Ebola. I mean, Dr. Kent Brantley's on our team. He was not there for Congo, but it's just that caliber of people that have experienced it. And so it was great to serve along with those people. Our first trip, we had a lot of expats. There were maybe, once again, like 50 of us, including administrative and everybody else. And so we were just working alongside the Congolese. We had Congolese doctors and nurses that we were working with. As time went on, we withdrew mostly expats. And the second time I went, there were just four of us, four nurses, and we each had different roles. But we were the ones kind of leading everything. And it was just then all Congolese staff. There's so many things about it, but I think it was really sad because our mandate was Ebola, but we saw so many other things, children that, malnourishment and just people that would come. We would triage people there, of course, that would come like everything they had was just in a bag. And then because we were, you know, testing them for Ebola, like, we had to burn it all. Like, everything that they owned in their bag, we had to burn it. Now, we gave them clothes when they left and everything, but it was just horrific having to do that. But it's because Ebola lives on those things. Like, we have to. Things that we could bleach, we would bleach and set in the sun, but most of that we couldn't. And then if you brought a child, the child had to stay by themselves. So you would have like a one-year-old, like the parents would have to drop the baby off. And we did have Congolese people, women and men, that had had Ebola. And so they were able to come in. They had the immunity, so they would come in and take care of these children. But that was just heartbreaking to see that and to have them have to go through that. The kids would have to be there for a couple days by themselves. I mean, we took care of them, but just the stress for the kids and the parents. And it was the first time we didn't have any positive cases. We just had suspect. And then the second time we did have positive cases. And, you know, some that lived, some that did not. We were giving therapeutic drugs, just the compassionate care of the different drugs that were available to help treat Ebola. We lived in tents, nice tents, but tents. We ate African food, mostly beans and rice and potatoes, and I think really good mangoes. I don't know if we've had those in Kenya, but so it was. It was. We had a bat that was flying through the.
Yeah. And we're wrapping up here talking with Kim McCarthy about her experience as a volunteer nurse for Samaritan's Purse and their international outreaches, and been to Italy for the treating COVID-19 patients, been to Bangladesh, been to the Congo twice to treat Ebola patients, Bahamas after the hurricane. When you first told your family, or even now, what's your family's reaction and response to? I mean, you have two adult children and your husband. What did they say at first, or what do they say now?
That is so. Well, they're all different. Claire, my daughter, is very excited. I mean, she just finished up her occupational therapy degree, and so she might fill out a DART application herself, and, you know, to see if she can be used in that way. So she's very excited. My son is never excited. He was okay with the Bahamas, but he is not happy about it. He fears that something will happen, and he can't promise that it won't. But, yeah, he's not necessarily a fan of me going. But when I get there, we have the WhatsApp, so we talk to each other, and I can show him everything. And, you know, he's an adult. He'll be 21 next week. But the thought of his mom going someplace like that, and he's not a fan. My husband is supportive. He is not ever really excited about it, like I am. It's not part of his calling, but he understands that it's part of mine, so he's supportive of it. And, you know, we talk while I'm there, and I tell him what's going on. I'd say Claire is probably the most excited, but everybody's different, you know? Everybody has different eyes to see and hear different things, so...
What's the future hold? I mean, is this the role that you will have? Is this the role you want to have? Is there more that could be done, in regards to administration or whether stateside? Or what are your thoughts about the future with Samaritan's Purse? And it's, you know, speculation, conjecture, but do you have some thoughts?
I mean, I love doing what I'm doing. I'm not sure it's like a long-term, forever sort of thing. Obviously, as the years go by, I mean, I still have pretty much energy, and the Lord's given me that to be able to do it. I know that I want to continue doing something with international missions. Is it with Samaritan's Purse? I don't know. Would it be with another group, or would I do like a longer term someplace else? I'm not saying years, but whatever, 6 months. There are opportunities within the organization to be a part of. One of the goals was to set up health in each office across the world that Samaritan's Purse has. They wanted to do some sort of medical programming in each office, whatever that looked like. So at one point, and I don't know if they're still doing this or if there's certain people that are doing it, but they were looking for people to go for a couple months. So you'd go make an assessment, make recommendations, and then try to start this program in that office. I think that's been done some. I'm not sure where they're at with that. I know that with DART, so that's what I do, the emergency field hospital part of it. They have, you know, the tent in New York as well, in New York City, that's still there. So we were running two DARTs at the same time, which is the first time we've ever done that, but it was one of the goals. And so I'm not sure. I do love patients. So, yeah, we'll just see. I don't feel like this is the end, but I don't know what the next step is.
Sure, sure. Now, is the hospital still up in Italy?
It is. It's up. My understanding is May 15th will be the last day. They've done a great job of decompressing that hospital, and they're just not going to be needed. There was concern over Easter holiday that people would be out, and also like Milan, which is maybe an hour or so away, hadn't been hit hard yet, and that maybe some of those patients would come. But so far, everything's like the numbers are down and the need is not there. So they should be wrapping up soon.
Yeah. And coming home to the States, what's your take on the, you know, not the lockdown, but sheltering in place and gearing things back up as a medical professional? What are your thoughts and opinions?
I mean, there's so many thoughts and opinions out there. I think definitely just listen to the professionals, the ones that are like leading the effort to open. It's a disease that you don't want, and it's a virus. And it's not just the flu. It's 20 times more virulent than the flu. So just listen to what they say and do it, and it will pass. But you may know people that die, and because it's you don't want it. And it does, you know, it has a negative impact on some. So that's my thought on it. Yeah. And then, you know, use your mask, wash your hands, all those things we, you know, don't want to do. We're not used to doing those sort of things. But if it saves your life or saves another person's life, I mean, why not? You know, and right now you're healthy. You know, right now unless you do have it, I mean, you don't. Mm-hmm. So that's a good thing. So be thankful you can wear a mask and do what you got to do. That's my 2 cents.
Yeah. Well, Kim, thank you so much for taking the time and for sharing some of your experiences and your purpose quest. And we're just so Proud is not the right word because we didn't have any role in this, but we certainly stand to the side and applaud you and just are so blessed to have had a spectator's view of your call and your purpose unfolding, and the Lord bless you for your commitment and for your sacrifice. You and all your family give you all peace, and keep up the good work. And the next time you go out, we'll have you back on to get a new report. Does that sound good?
It sounds wonderful. Thank you so much.
All righty. You take care. Say hello to the family.
Okay. Thank you. Yeah. Thank
Bye-bye.
You. Bye.
Bye-bye. All right, Kim McCarthy, what a goosebumps. You know, this is because I have watched her purpose story unfold. I can remember a coffee meeting we had at our church when she was considering applying, and I said, why not? And you can always say no. You can always back out. And I said, but I think you know in your heart what it is you want to do. And it is a big step. And, you know, I was reflecting the other day, if we have somebody in our culture who goes away in the Army or the Armed Forces and serves for 6 months away from family, we say, wow. We applaud them. We let them on the planes first. We salute them at our sporting events. Kim and others are serving the kingdom and away from their families. And that's not fanaticism. That's a different army that they are called to. And what she did in those 4 weeks, and Kim's very sensitive. You could hear that she choked up several times, and as she did in Kenya when she beheld the condition of the children. And so it's a very tender heart. But she's out doing what she was trained to do and created to do, and we just couldn't be happier for her, and just pray God's protection upon her and her blessing upon her family. Tomorrow we're back in the medical profession. We're going to have Dr. Rhonda Johnson, who just came back from Kenya. We just got back in the country before a couple weeks before things shut down. But Dr. Johnson is with the Allegheny Health Network, and she's been on Facebook doing lots of videos talking about this pandemic. And so we're going to hear from her about what her role is in Allegheny Health Network, what her perspective is in this time, and about the gearing back up the economy and getting back out there, and also hear about what she has to say about her experience in Kenya as well. So that is Tuesday, and then Wednesday we got Charlene Dominic, who is just delightful. She's done 3 booklets, and we're converting into 1 bigger book now through Urban Press. But she's got a sunflower house that she is opening up for women's ministry. We want to get that report Thursday, is my friend Doug Sprague. And I just got word today that Ola Jackson, the founder of the Onyx Women's Network, is going to be with us on Friday to talk about her purpose work. We've got a great week ahead. Again, my thanks to Kim McCarthy for her just outstanding service and a great interview. My thanks to you for listening, and we'll be back tomorrow. So until then, this is John Stenko, your host, signing off and just encouraging you in the hours until we're together again, be about the work of purpose in your life. So long for now.
Thanks again for listening to Wake Up to Purpose with John Stanko. To get in touch with John, you can go to www.purposequest.com or write him at johnstanko@gmail.com.